Hello and welcome to a New Year's special edition of Ian Masters Background Briefing and Live from the Left Coast. I'm producer Louis Vandenberg. Ian Masters covered a number of elements that drove the news over the year 2006, but no theme appeared more frequently than the American occupation of Iraq, what General William Odom has described on this program as the greatest strategic mistake in American history. The interviews we will feature today center on Iraq. The transformation of quagmire into catastrophe as Iraq descends into civil war. In the next 2 hours, we will look back at 2006 in discussions with Gary Hart, Lawrence Wilkerson, Nir Rosen, Ron Suskind, and Sidney Blumenthal. We begin with former Senator Gary Hart in an interview broadcast February 24, 2006. Ian and I had recorded this interview the day before at the Southern California home of Max Kennedy, son of Senator and presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy. For the interview, we used Max Kennedy's home office, which was cluttered with historic photographs and memorabilia, manuscripts, computers, accessories, and books. Senator Hart sat at the desk, Ian a bit to the side, facing him. The window behind Hart opened to beautiful green foliage and a small stream. There were dogs and children and life and family, the Kennedy tradition, in and around the house. I couldn't help but to contrast the dire picture Ian and the senator drew in their conversation with the peace and beauty in which the conversation took place. Ian Masters and Senator Gary Hart, recorded February 23rd, 2006.
I'm speaking with Gary Hart, the author of The Shield and the Cloak, The Security of the Commons. Gary Hart's represented Colorado in the United States Senate from 1975 to 1987. He's the author of 15 books. He's taught at Yale, lectured at the University of California and Oxford University, and has earned a Doctor of Philosophy in Politics in 2001. As a co-chair of the United States Commission on National Security in the 21st century, he was credited with forecasting a 9/11 type attack. And your new book deals with strategy and a strategic vision, which has always seems to be lacking, I'm afraid. And here we have our latest adventure or misadventure in the Middle East, which apparently lacked any strategic vision, collapsing around our ears. Is much of what we're going to be talking about in the next year or so who lost the Middle East?
Quite possibly. If civil war breaks out in Iraq, and let me qualify that I'm not a Middle East expert, but most people who are believe it will quickly spread beyond its borders, in which case the challenge will be to get America's army out of there before it's destroyed. I don't mean to be apocalyptic, but I was thinking today of Napoleon in Moscow in 1812. The people of Moscow retreated. Napoleon occupied their capital. They burned it down around him, and he lost his army getting out of Russia. And I think it's not too great of a dramatization to say something like that. 1 in 10 chances something like that could happen to the United States Army.
But this is not to say that the United States is weak. This is an indictment of the impetuous and immature use of American power.
Precisely.
Which has undermined our strength. So this is what I'm afraid of, is that the jihadis already believe, they're delusional, but they believe that they were the reason that brought down the evil empire, the Soviet Union, from Afghanistan. And if they drive us out of Iraq, which is, I think, quite likely, then they'll be drunk with power. They'll feel that they've defeated two superpowers.
Well, I think one of the regional strategic fears is that Shiites in Iran will make common cause, obviously, with their colleagues across the border. And then you have the possibility for a major shift of power and influence in the region, influencing the Saudis, influencing oil supplies, and all the other things that we hold dear about that region.
Well, I think it's already happened, hasn't it, that our strategic blunder in Iraq has rewarded Iran, you know. I mean,
they've managed to strengthen their hand two ways. One, the rise of the Shiite influence, the majority Shiite influence in Iraq, and two, their at least for the time being, they're thumbing their nose at us and the Western democracies on the issue of nuclear energy.
So there's also the possibility that I mean, Indrajit's hand is behind this unrest. It's his way of reminding us who's got the levers of power in that part of the world.
Oh, I think no question about that.
The moment we're at seems to be such a powerful one in terms of a portent of a terrible American defeat. Do you think that the president can get out of this? Because I believe that their strategy will be to say, well, we did the best we could, we tried, it failed, not our fault, it's their fault, they don't want democracy. And the American people, I think, are so anxious about this mistake, they'd like to get out of it. You think it'll be forgive and forget?
I think you can't have 25,000 casualties, which is what we've suffered, and to a degree our British allies as well, without some recrimination. Somebody sometime is going to start asking questions, how did this all happen? Now, it hasn't happened now for very peculiar political reasons, and that is both houses of the Congress belong to the president's party. And to my knowledge, there's not been 1 minute of hearings in either house on the conduct of the war for 3 years. And all you have to do is think back to the 60s and early 70s, where a Democratic Congress held hearings on Vietnam while a Democrat, at least in Lyndon Johnson's time, was in office and helped bring about the end of that war. But the Republicans in Congress are not doing that. I think, frankly, as we did not learn from the French experience in Indochina, we did not learn from the British experience in the Middle East and particularly in Iraq.
Well, it remains to be seen, I guess, whether there'll be accountability. But I think we'll maybe a good part of a trillion in the hole, as together with the 25,000 lives and perhaps 100,000 Iraqi lives.
Yes.
Let's turn to your book, The Shield and the Cloak, The Security of the Commons. And, of course, you had a prominent role as a co-chair of the United States Commission on National Security in the 21st Century, and where you warned of massive homeland security terror attacks as early. This took place in the fall of 1999, and you spent the 8 months of 2001 trying to persuade government leaders that the threat was urgent and action was needed. And I believe you spoke to Condoleezza Rice the day before, or was it 2 days
before?
What
happened was I had known her. She got her graduate degrees from the University of Denver, and when I was a candidate for national office in 1984, she helped advise me on U.S.-Soviet relations, which was her specialty as a graduate student. So I'd known her off and on over the years and kept in touch with her when she was at Stanford. And so I met her, I saw her after she was named National Security Advisor in the spring of 2001, and she said, come around and I'd love to talk to you. I didn't have an opportunity until that fall, and I gave a speech, ironically, to the International Air Transportation Association in Montreal. And the headlines in the Montreal papers the next morning were, Hart predicts terrorist attacks on America. And I flew directly down to Washington, went to her office, and I said, please, please get going on Homeland Security. And that was September the 6th, 5 days before the attack.
Do you think that we got off on the wrong foot in the sense that after 9/11, after all, the United Nations is headquartered in New York, the funeral pyres of 3,000 souls are still in the air, and our first impulse, at least our government's first impulse, was unilateralism as opposed to the multilateral opportunity that was presented with all of the world's sympathy. The fact that the UN is headquartered in New York, almost a company town, and more importantly, the problem of terrorism is over there, not here. So it seems like a no-brainer that you've got to engage others.
There were ideological imperatives behind all this. Richard Clark documented this in his book on the early Bush years, and others have supported that since then, including the chief of staff to former Secretary of State Colin Powell. And they both said that the principles in the Bush administration came into office with Saddam Hussein in their gun sights. And every time, Richard Clark said, every time he would encounter Paul Wolfowitz or anyone else in the halls of the or corridors of the White House, and he would say Al-Qaeda and bin Laden, the response he got was Saddam Hussein and Iraq. Now, this all started with the so-called Project for a New American Century in the 1990s. The signers of a letter to Bill Clinton in 1998 urging the overthrow of Saddam Hussein were almost all of the same people, so-called neoconservatives, who concocted the war against Saddam. And I gather from news reports in the last few days, there are memos where Donald Rumsfeld is quoted as saying, on the afternoon of September the 11th, link this to Saddam, whatever it takes. That is scandalous, historically scandalous.
Well, I believe the first meeting that took place after the president settled down and went to Camp David, that both Wolfowitz and Rumsfeld did proffer this idea of attacking Iraq.
Proffering it for years before that. So all they did was use the excuse of the attacks to carry out an agenda in the Middle East. I mean, I think the long-term objective was imperial. That is to say, we'll depose Saddam, we'll impose a Chalabi-friendly government, and they will then invite us to base ourselves politically and militarily in their country, and we can then dominate the region.
But even President Bush's own father counseled against it. All of his people understood at the end of the first Gulf War that once you break it, you own it, to quote Colin Powell. And surely that counsel was offered. Was it heard?
I mean, clearly not, or things right. would have been different. Yeah. I think what happened was in the so-called neoconservatives, it felt that Bush the father and his ilk were so-called foreign policy realists. That is to say, they managed the world according to kind of the realities of the day, whereas the neoconservatives held themselves out to be visionaries, and in heavily ideological sense, that it was their mission to remake the world. And it was that's vastly different from what the father believed.
How do you explain, though, this capture of U.S. foreign policy? If you had this tradition that I guess it goes through the Kissingerian period, which is to manage things, that there's no absolute good or evil, versions of realpolitik where you act in your interests, not necessarily according to your ideals. These people have been around forever. How did they capture the foreign policy? Because it seems to me the chief enablers of this have to be Rumsfeld and Cheney, because I don't, these people haven't written that much. They're just good on television at filibustering people. In fact, that's why Brent Scowcroft didn't step up to the plate. He just didn't want to be shouted at on television because he's a gentleman.
Well, he wrote a contrarian op-ed piece in the New York Times, and they just took his head off as being out of date. Right. I think it goes back to the Cold War, second half of the Cold War. The people that have tried to answer that question there was an intellectual underpinning, and it was involved Robert Kagan and William Kristol and a variety of number of people who strongly disagreed, particularly with Ronald Reagan's second term embrace of Gorbachev. Right. They hated the Soviet Union. It turns out they also hated Russia, which is an even broader proposition. And they felt dealing with them rather than crushing them was morally wrong. Right. And that when the Cold War ended, then they were in search for a decade of a new cause. Right. And when George Bush came into office, they didn't have that cause until 9/11. And they overthrew the Taliban and then went about what they really were up to, which was dominating the Middle East.
But they got the Cold War wrong. The Team B got everything wrong, which was the genesis of the same group of people.
Of course.
The whole idea of the war on terror, the earlier war on terror, the Soviet behind terror, turned out that they were actually quoting CIA black propaganda.
Yes.
And eventually, they had to tell Bill Casey that that this is our own stuff. They've got this thing wrong as well.
Well, this is an important point.
Is this the end of them?
This is an important point, because when you say Team B, they were trying to get the CIA to say certain things that the CIA didn't believe. Right. And so there has always been this tension between the genuine, honest intelligence community and the ideologues who want them to deliver opinions that they don't believe in. And that's why I think they put a medal around George Tenet's neck, because he finally caved in.
Well, you deal with intelligence in your new book, The Shield and the Cloak. It's a part of a number of things that you're suggesting. Have we reformed intelligence? I mean, is the DNI... I mean, it seems to me just another political layer.
It is. It is. And I think if you go back in the history of how the CIA was created in the National Security Act of 1947, it was created in with the opposition of the Defense Department. The Defense Department did not want an independent intelligence agency. And so between 1947 and 2001, there was this constant tension and struggle between DOD, Defense Department, and CIA, and when Donald Rumsfeld came in, he simply bypassed it. When the CIA wouldn't give him what he wanted, he created his own intelligence operation in the Pentagon that was ideologically stacked to turn out the opinions that he wanted.
It is scandalous, and in the context of this vast effort in the Middle East, turning not just into being counterproductive, but maybe the ultimate scenarios that you talk about in your book, where we'll have an oil shutdown. I mean, it's not preposterous, and it's not unlikely.
No.
So let's run through some of the suggestions you've got in terms. I mean, the opening statement I made is we desperately need strategic vision. I mean,
yes.
You know, without strategic vision, whatever you do tactically, it's whistling past the graveyard. It was that way in Vietnam, and it's that way in Iraq.
Yes. Well, the book posits two premises that are new and different, I think. I don't know anyone else that is making these arguments. First is that security in the 21st century is going to look like and sound like much differently from the 20th. The 20th century's national security meant prevention of an exchange of nuclear missiles between us and the Soviet Union. My argument is in the 21st century, security is inevitably going to include security of livelihood, the ability of a family to provide for itself, security of the community, security of energy, and security of the environment. If any of those things goes wrong, we can have secure borders and people are not going to feel secure. And the second argument is there is the notion of national security. Increasingly in the globalized world, we cannot be secure if the rest of the world is insecure, at least our democratic allies. So the idea of going in alone, as we did in Iraq, is pure folly if you really do care about making America secure. We need our allies' help. And so those are the two basic arguments. And then I have specifics about creation of an international peacemaking force, declaring Persian Gulf a zone of international interest and turning it over to the UN to guarantee oil supplies, creation of a human intelligence corps within the CIA, and a group of ideas like that.
And just in terms of politics, don't you think that these ideas need a new kind of polity, that we have these kind of stale, rigid, Democratic-Republican positions now? The Democrats have always been on the defensive on national security, and curiously enough, it's this ports issue that's brought them back up, and that's a bogus issue, but I'm happy to see somebody beating up the president with something. But the long and the short of it is, you can form your coalitions, for example, the environmentalists on the left and the national security hawks on the right. Recognize, I think, that going green is a national security imperative.
Yes.
So do you see any hope here of creating new political coalitions?
Well, the purpose of the book, frankly, is to give my party ideas, if not intellectual content, for the formulation of a new security policy. Simply voting against the president, which the Democrats haven't been doing very much of, or saying we should cut the defense budget isn't a policy. And I think it's part of the reason since Vietnam that we have lost the confidence of the American people. So I think there are a set of principles and concrete proposals that the Democrats can stand on. And if they don't like mine, then they should come up with some of their own. But until we convince the majority of people in this country that we can make America at least as secure as the president and the Republicans, I think we're always going to be in the minority.
And do you think that that there will be, there's been talk about a contract with America type of democratic manifesto? It's been in the works for a while there. I mean, is there, I mean, I can see that you're stepping up to the plate here, because I don't see a lot of of intellectual hardware out there.
I think that's absolutely true, and I've sat in on, I sat in on a session 3 or 4 months ago in Washington where 60 people were around the table representing almost that many ancillary affiliate organizations of the Democratic Party, and it was a cacophony of ideas and proposals, none of which gelled into anything concrete.
And what about in terms of you got the new Human Intelligence Corps and a special forces, which I guess is separate from or apart from the four services that have their own special forces.
Yes.
What's the idea there?
Well, the idea is that each of the traditional services has its own special branch or special force,
right,
and they do cooperate. But I think if the warfare of the future is as it was in Mogadishu and Fallujah, you are going to need a fifth service, which consolidates the Rangers, the Delta Force, the SEALs, and those other special intervention forces so that they are trained and equipped to operate together.
And what about the cultural deficit? For example, let's take Fallujah. I mean, we don't have many people that speak Arabic, and certainly not, they don't know the town. A lot of it was, you know, probably could have been negotiated away. The Marines weren't happy going in there. They had to go into because a bunch of contractors got killed. That leads into the broader question about what are the soft levers that you can use? For example, do you get more bang for the buck with Peace Corps, AID, NGOs, humanitarian aid? I mean, have we done an accounting on whether the what we spend militarily could be achieved, not, you know, in part by other measures?
What Joe Nye calls soft power. Absolutely. I think there's no question about it. I make my own argument on that. Actually, I had a previous book about a year or a year and a half ago called The Fourth Power, which is America's principles. Together with our economic, political, and military power, we have a fourth power, which are our constitutional systems and principles that we abandon and neglect at our peril and to our detriment.
Well, we've disgraced at Abu Ghraib and Gitmo.
Absolutely.
Has had terrible consequences.
Yes.
The decent, what is it, the decent respect for the opinions of mankind?
Jefferson. No, yeah. But the gap, hypocrisy is defined as the gap between what you claim and what you do.
Right.
And in this case, we're a very hypocritical nation, no question about it. But in principle, yes, you're absolutely right. We're not an administration, a government committed to use of military force to solve the world's problems is shortchanging the human side of the equation.
So what, just in terms of the current disaster that we're seeing unfold here in Iraq and the possibility of a massive scale April 1975 Saigon retreat under fire and a national humiliation, again, not necessarily one that reflects the power of the United States, but the abuse of power in the sense that this was not properly thought out and not properly executed. Nevertheless, we do have, and most of your ideas here are about reorienting the military, but we have this bizarre situation where not only is money going out the door in supplementals to the Halliburtons of this world without any oversight, we still have the old Cold War weapon system.
Yes.
So it's not as if it's an either-or situation where the Pentagon has had to say, look, we've got a new threat out here. We're going to have to be lean and mean and smart and no more, you know, let's get the Timex version, not the Rolex version of the weapon system. We don't need all this, these F-22s and all this stuff.
Right.
But the bizarre thing that's going on now is that they're funding both.
I know.
And we're going broke.
I know. This is because there is an administration that is not exercising any restraint on military spending. So it's everything for everybody. It's pretty much the same with our domestic surveillance, for example. Alberto Gonzalez gets anything he wants. The Patriot Act was roughly the domestic equivalent of what you're talking about. That is to say, give the security people anything they want, and if they abuse it, that's too bad. No, but you're absolutely right. The great ship of defense is sailing down the ocean, still on the course that it was in the Cold War years, but we're also now realizing Donald Rumsfeld's beginning to go lighter and quicker and faster, but he doesn't have a clue as to what the nature of the warfare of the future is. And it really is Mogadishu and Fallujah. It's low-intensity urban conflict between and among tribes, clans, and gangs, increasingly, and that's not the warfare we're preparing for.
But you point out here that there's diplomacy, finance, and the military. Those are the three prongs.
Economics, politics, and
in other words, you try and persuade, you bribe, or you beat them over the head. And it
those
seems
were my terms, but somebody else said.
Yeah, yeah. But the long and the short of it is, in a position then, with what's happening to us now, to maintain the kind of people in the military? I mean, the best and brightest have been sent into harm's way without proper body armor, without a mission, without an exit strategy, and based on a bunch of lies, to be blunt. At least the administration's never had a straight story about why we went in. They've changed their mind periodically. So what about our capital in terms of the boys and girls in uniform? Do you think they're still going to step up to the plate?
Well, yes, I do. But even more to the litany that you mentioned, I would add repeated deployments or continued deployments, not only of the regular forces who sign on for that, right, but the reserve force. 40% of our forces there are National Guard and Reserve, and they've been re-upped, as they say. They've been right. their tours have been extended over and over and over again. What it does is deplete the forces, both regular and reserve, and the equipment that they use. It took us 15 to 20 years to recover after Vietnam to rebuild our forces. It will take us at least the same length of time after Iraq.
So you're not worried then that this is going to make the military, like, you know, after Vietnam, the military were orphans. Nobody wanted to join. It is a volunteer military. So does that in any way suggest the need for a draft?
No, unless cataclysm broke out, obviously, right, and hordes were pouring across our borders. But what it does mean is we're going to have to reward the people who do opt for military service better than we are. And I don't mean just monetarily, but in terms of taking care of their families. Mm-hmm. The livelihood of the families of some of these lower-ranking soldiers is pretty grim. And then you've got the problem of taking care of the veterans when they come home. And one of the ironies of American politics is those who are most eager to go to war are those who often do not vote for the resources necessary to support the veterans when they come back.
Well, I just saw on television a grandfather going off to war. I mean, you get the feeling that they're pushing the limits of the Guard.
There's no question.
But on the notion of a because many people on the left have a knee-jerk reaction to the draft, they think that this is going to be inevitable, and then, you know, the draft army in the Vietnam War was one of the reasons that we forced us to get out. Isn't there a more holistic way to look at national service? I mean, couldn't you have a draft, for example, that allowed people to go into the Peace Corps, to the Conservation Corps, to the Nursing Corps? I mean, a lot of, you know, in other words, a sense of public service is, I mean, are you satisfied that the volunteer army is the way to go, or do you still have some sense of going back to the founding fathers, the citizens' army?
These are apples and oranges. I have been an advocate for 25 years of national service, but voluntary national service.
Right.
We will not go back to the draft because the people of this country won't support it.
Right.
Not only the young people, but their parents as well. They don't see the need for it. Lyndon Johnson was able to fight the Vietnam War because we had a draft in being at the time. He didn't have to institute a draft. Mm-hmm. And since 75, 30 years, we have not had that draft. If we proposed it today, the streets of Los Angeles and everywhere else would be full of students and young people protesting, and that would be the end of it. So, but I do believe there ought to be, in the Kennedy-esque sense of the word, the opportunity for young people to give something back to their country, either as civilians or in the military.
But that's it's odd because people really, the only bright light in Katrina was the National Guardsmen showing up.
Right.
So, I mean, I don't get the disconnect between the kids who'd be furious about the draft, at the same time, the sense that you could appeal to the same generation, you know,
for
national service.
Appealing to them and ordering them.
I see. So you'd take the gentle approach.
I'd appeal to them. Well, I think the president, I mean, the National Guard ought to be here. The commission on which I serve said that under our Constitution, what was called the militia in the early days, now the National Guard, is given the constitutional mandate to protect this country at home. And they're all over in Iraq. And disproportionately, they're made up of the so-called first responders, cops, firemen, emergency health workers. So we are doubly vulnerable here in this country. Those first responders are over there, and they're wearing National Guard uniforms, and they should be here being equipped and trained for the terrorist threat.
Well, just, Gary Hart, on the terrorist threat, it does seem that the president often brings up bin Laden, and bin Laden himself makes the odd appearance on Al Jazeera. But just recently, the president said we've got to take bin Laden's threat seriously. It's sort of in contrast at one of the darkest moments in this country's history. FDR said we have nothing to fear but fear itself. So I don't understand how it is that the lone superpower is quaking in its boots. I mean, has the president inadvertently elevated bin Laden on the world stage as an equal player by continually making him the threat that he says he is? I just fail to see how a cave dweller is equal to the lone superpower.
The answer to your question is yes, the president has, in the service of keeping the Iraq war going. And it's a non sequitur in the sense that we let bin Laden get away and Tora Bora, along with possibly 3,000 to 4,000 Taliban and al-Qaeda supporters, in order to prosecute the war against Saddam, who had nothing to do with the attacks on this country. And the mythology, as you've said, you used the word lies, I would say the mythology over the past 3 or 4 years has been this is somehow connected, and it simply is not. They had a pre-terrorist scheme to overthrow Saddam Hussein, full stop.
But given that response, they didn't necessarily follow your prescription from the Hart-Rudman Commission, although you're the first to enunciate the need for homeland security. The homeland security is becoming the butt of everybody's joke. You've just seen the hearings.
Right.
I don't think anybody has any confidence. It seems like $80 billion have gone for a color code. They tell you what day an attack is likely, but not what you can do. So, they've devalued this this notion. So, fear is that our response, and if we are attacked again, which is, I imagine, will happen eventually, that we will essentially punish ourselves. We'll go into a frenzy. You know, so far, you travel a lot at the airports. It's less convenient, right?
Yes, for sure.
That doesn't mean that somebody couldn't go and place a nuke inside a container. It's just that's where all our focus has been. So what about this idea that we punish ourselves and not the bad guys?
Well, we're punishing ourselves in the wrong way. Port security, leaving aside the Dubai issue, port security is a serious, serious problem. We're inspecting fewer than 5% of the containers coming into this country, and that's a big, big problem. Back to the department, here ideology does play a role. If you don't believe in government, then you're probably not going to be very good at it. And Republicans don't believe in government. So what do? Reluctantly, they created the department, and then they made a hash of it by putting incompetent people in charge. And David Brooks in the New York Times then writes, see, this is proof government doesn't work.
Because
so it's a cyclical argument.
So the Michael Browns, the kind of
exactly
affirmative action for country club Republicans.
Or horse trainers or whatever he was.
Well, I thank you very much for your book.
Great pleasure.
The Shield and the Cloak, The Security of the Commons. And I appreciate the fact that somebody out there is thinking about these big issues. I thank you so much for joining
me. Great pleasure. Thank you.
That was Ian Masters with former Senator Gary Hart, recorded February 23rd, 2006. We now turn to Ian's interview with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, which took place 2 weeks later on March 12, 2006. Wilkerson had done something quite unusual during the Bush presidency. He had, in an act of statesmanship and patriotism, stepped out of the shadows and secrecy to pull back the curtain and reveal what he described as the Cheney-Rumsfeld cabal that had hijacked U.S. foreign policy. That the torture policies came from Dick Cheney's office, and that his former boss, Secretary of State Colin Powell, was anguished in the presentation he made to the UN Security Council February 2003. We had been working to get Colonel Wilkerson on the program for some time, and Ian had many, many questions for him. I need to thank my friend Steve Clemens of the New America Foundation for the help he provided in making this interview possible. Ian Masters and Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, March 12, 2006.
I'm now speaking with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who was Secretary of State Colin Powell's Chief of Staff at the Department of State from August 2002 to January 2005. Colonel Wilkerson's career with Colin Powell goes back to March of 1989 at the U.S. Army's Forces Command in Atlanta, Georgia, where Colonel Wilkerson was Colin Powell's Deputy Executive Officer. He followed Colin Powell to become his Special Assistant as Colin Powell was Chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, and upon Colin Powell's retirement from active service in 1983, Colonel Wilkerson served as the Deputy Director and Director of the United States Marine Corps War College at Quantico, Virginia, and he retired from active service in 1997. He then began working for Colin Powell in private capacity as a consultant and advisor, and then in December 2000, Secretary of State designate Colin Powell asked Colonel Wilkerson to join him in the transition office at the United States State Department, and upon his confirmation as Secretary of State, Secretary Powell moved Colonel Wilkerson to the policy planning staff with responsibility for East Asia and the Pacific. In June of 2002, the Director of Policy Planning, Ambassador Richard Haass, made Colonel Wilkerson the Associate Director, and in August of 2002, Secretary Powell moved Wilkerson to the position of Chief of Staff of the Department. And in October of 2005, Colonel Wilkerson, after considerable soul-searching, went public to tell uncomfortable truths about the inner workings of the Bush administration. And I guess amid the headlines, Colonel Wilkerson, about Vice President Cheney providing guidance that led to America's torture, disgrace in Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and elsewhere, and the reporting about Secretary Powell's February 2003 presentation at the United Nations as the lowest point in his life, what seems to have gotten perhaps overlooked in this is the extent to which I thought what you're trying to focus on and trying to provide the public with is the fact that this administration has not used the counsel, experience, and knowledge of the bureaucracies in Washington and in circumventing them. Do you believe at this point that they're paying the price?
I certainly do. I noted with some degree of encouragement this morning in the Outlook session of the Washington Post back here that David Rothkopf has written a piece. I'm using his textbook right now to teach from, his textbook on running the world, the latest book on the National Security Council process. And he says that in this recent article in the Outlook section of the Post that Dr. Rice has won and that Vice President Cheney and his crowd have been relegated to the woodwork, and that we shall see a very, very different administration now over the next 3 years, if indeed we aren't already seeing it. I applaud that if it's true, but I await substance before I decide whether it's true or not.
But I was under the impression that Dr. Rice had in fact become the president's private tutor in the first 4 years, had not really, I mean, the National Security Advisor's principal job is basically the only person in the president's corner to protect the president, even as Henry Kissinger did with Nixon, protect him from himself. And you got the impression that in the first term she spent most of her time as his private tutor and was essentially rolled by the more experienced Cheney-Rumsfeld, as you described, cabal. And, of course, people should realize that it was, after all, Rumsfeld who brought Cheney into government. So it's a pretty tight bond there, is it not?
But I take David's point this morning in his piece in the Post because, let's face it, the Rumsfeld-Cheney cabal has brought disaster, unparalleled disaster, upon this administration. It is arguably now viewed across America as one of the most inept, incompetent administrations in American history. And I think probably one of the points David is trying to make is that even a president who needed tutoring for 4 years is smart enough to awaken to that fact. And I hope David's right. I hope that the vice president and secretary of defense, David also says in his book that the thing that diminishes power most rapidly and most substantially is failure. Well, this administration's power should be diminished considerably because it's had nothing but failure.
And I did a long interview with David about his book where he had access to all of the previous national security advisors and key staff, and took us through the importance of the National Security Council. But just on following that point you made, Colonel Wilkerson, do you believe that President Bush himself, who has a reputation for being somewhat detached, does he recognize, because the impression one gets is that he doesn't get a broad input of information, and perhaps he's somewhat delusional about what's really happening in Iraq?
Well, I won't discount that entirely, although I do think David's point that it's diminished rapidly over this last 8 to 9 months because it's been very difficult to avoid the negative news. Even if you don't read the paper, even if you don't watch the television, even if you don't get your news from a wide spectrum of the bureaucracy, and even if the bureaucracy is being more or less sycophantic and not telling you the truth, still something has to seep through of the significance of the failure thus far in Iraq, and not just in Iraq. Let's take the January 2000 State of the Union address, where the president very boldly identified the axis of evil, almost as if he were attempting to template words of the great communicator Ronald Reagan when he hurled the evil empire epithet at the Soviet Union, and by doing so falling into one of the classic traps history offers for decision makers, and that is you can't template the past for the present and the future. But nonetheless, let's look at 2002 and the axis of evil, and let's examine the axis of evil today. Disastrous failures on all three counts. Six-party talks, moribund and dead, with Pyongyang, North Korea making more nuclear weapons, not less. Iran, probably the biggest threat America confronts today, and with no apparent diplomatic initiatives of any substance left, we've forfeited all the opportunities to talk to Tehran when we had maximum leverage over them, for example. And Iraq. Iraq itself, which looked like low-hanging fruit on the axis of evil and easily taken out, has turned out to be a disaster. And the greatest winner from our failure in Iraq is Iran. Iran won the 15 December elections. She rid herself of her number one enemy in the region, Iraq, without firing a shot. She's reasserted her leadership over the radical Islamic world, leadership that bin Laden took over on 9/11 with Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Iran stands right now to be the regional victor in our having invaded Baghdad. What a turn of events there.
Well, indeed, you could say that what we've our policies have done is, perhaps in terms of blowback, they have emboldened and strengthened the most virulent form of radical Shiism and the most virulent form of radical Sunniism.
Absolutely.
Ahmadinejad and al-Qaeda.
Absolutely. And exacerbated our own situation in our failure to recognize that this is fundamentally a war of ideas. And in invading Iraq, we contaminated our own ideas, everything from torture to the invasion in the first place. And if we have a struggle here, this struggle is with Islam itself in order to get the great mass of Islam more or less on our side, and against al-Qaeda and al-Qaeda-like organizations. And in that regard, we're losing. Iraq has probably turned out to be the greatest boon for recruiting bin Laden could have asked for.
Well, I think at this point, with Iraq teetering on the cusp of a civil war, if it takes the plunge, I don't think you can avoid a broader regional war. And given that the provocation recently with the bombing of the mosque in Samarra, that apparently, I didn't realize this, I talked to Bob Baer, the former CIA officer, last week about this. He said that Ahmadinejad is an apocalyptic Shia convert, and that he, or not a convert, but a follower, I should say, and that he is a follower of the hidden imam, and that is the mosque where the hidden imam disappeared from, the one that was bombed. So he thinks that Ahmadinejad is basically in a very apocalyptic frame of mind at this point. So is it possible that this could spin out of control? I mean, you said that Iran's become, we've gifted Iran, as it were. In a regional war situation, do you think it's possible that, for example, the Saudi oil would go off the market because of terrorism, and somehow Iran could stay on the market, or will the whole place become a cauldron?
I think it's very difficult to predict anything right now. One of the greatest indications of failure in the diplomatic world is when you get to a situation like this, where either because of your failed diplomacy or your no diplomacy in this case, you've gotten to a situation where, as the president is wont to say, all the options are on the table. But in fact, there are no options on the table. The only option on the table here is precision-guided strikes against whatever facilities that Iran has that we could perhaps take out and perhaps delay their nuclear program. That's getting pretty bad when those are the only options you have left. We've forfeited all the other options that we might have had in the past 3 to 4 years by refusing to start any kind of strategic dialogue with Tehran. The same way we forfeited any chance with Pyongyang because we refused to start any kind of strategic dialogue that's meaningful with Pyongyang because, as the vice president might put it, we don't speak to evil.
Well, it's worth noting that the three axis of evil countries, Iran, of course, Iraq is become a different situation, but Iran and North Korea, we don't have any diplomatic relations with, and we entirely rely upon overhead photography, etc. And it seems to me that
it's abysmally inefficient.
Why don't we just take the plunge and recognize them? Whatever the trade-off is, it seems to be it would be worth having people on the ground.
Well, you're speaking in a sane way.
I won't get a job on Fox News if I keep that up.
Look at Pyongyang. I mean, we had IAEA inspectors on the ground at Yongbyon. We had the graphite rods out of the reactor there. We had eyes and ears all over the place, IAEA eyes and ears as well as others. We had South Koreans, cheek and jowl, working with the North Koreans through KEDO and the light water reactor facility area where we were building the foundations and everything. We had all manner of things. Plus, the plutonium program was effectively frozen. Now, look at what we've got. Nothing. And the North Koreans are building whatever bombs they want to build at whatever speed they want to build the bombs at. That's what our diplomacy got us. That's what our refusal to talk to, quote, evil, unquote, got us. Absolutely nothing except negativity and backwards.
So if the genesis of this kind of hubristic attitude, well, let me ask you, if it's the Cheney-Rumsfeld cabal that's responsible for this guidance in terms of the president, what were they thinking? I mean, is it a personality thing? Are they sort of throwbacks to a day when we had unlimited power? I mean, this has seemed to be the great tragedy of what they've wrought, is that their impetuous and ill-conceived use of our power has undermined our strength, and if we have to withdraw from Iraq, it'll be a catastrophe for the United States in perceptual terms.
I agree. I think you put your finger on the major criticism that I would make of this administration besides its ineptitude, and that is that they believe American power is unlimited. Whether you look at their ahistorical and atraditional interpretation of Article 2 of the Constitution, or whether you look at how they feel the resolution that Congress passed and the few words, three words, Commander-in-Chief in Section 2 of the Article 2 of the Constitution enable the Commander-in-Chief to do almost anything he wants to do, whether you look at any of these things or you look at the diplomacy towards the axis of evil, you have to conclude that they believe American power is unlimited. And since it clearly is not unlimited, they have so to speak, met their maker in the last 4 years. And that's one reason I hope David's right when he says the people who most stridently advocated this sort of concept of unlimited American power, and oh, by the way, unlimited executive power to wield that power, these people have been relegated to the woodwork. I hope David's right. I hope that the next 3 years we'll see Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld heard very little of.
Well, and that's to some maybe a tall order. I mean, Henry Kissinger described Rumsfeld as one of the great bureaucratic operators of all time. It's considerable praise coming from Kissinger, and Dick Cheney, from all intents and purposes, apparently is almost in a corporate terms, he's the COO, the chief operating officer, whereas the president appears to be the chief executive officer, taking care of the shareholders, making speeches, etc. But the real levers of power seem to flow through Cheney and through Addington, his chief of staff, it used to be Libby, and through a sort of group of these like-minded lawyers that they have in key positions. And I think, isn't that the mechanism where they have bypassed the normal input from government officials?
Certainly is in the past. I will reserve my judgment until I see results of what David is predicting. But I do note, with some caution and a bit of guarded optimism, I do note that the vice president has been unusually quiet of late. And I also note that the Secretary of Defense is becoming increasingly aware, I think, of the fact that he's presiding over what might be called the slow death of a thousand cuts of the Army and the Marine Corps. And those are real mesmerizing happenings, I think. And it's very difficult for me to imagine a man as smart as Donald Rumsfeld is and as good a bureaucratic entrepreneur, as you indicated, as Donald Rumsfeld is. Indeed, the only man to have bested Henry Kissinger not once, but several times. It's hard for me to believe that he doesn't realize by now, 5 years into this, the damage he's done, and isn't searching for ways to think more about his legacy now, and isn't going to be doing things to try and rectify some of the damage he's done. And that's very time-consuming, and doesn't allow for much else besides that. So I cross my fingers and I hope that we're going to have the next. I mean, these people have 2-3 years left to go. A lot of damage can be done in that time. And I hope beyond hope that this president has learned to moderate some of his hubris, some of his arrogance, and to depend less on those two members of administration and more on Dr. Rice and other members of the administration whose views are a hell of a lot more moderate than Rumsfeld's and Cheney's.
Just anecdotally, the CIA officer I had on last week, Bob Baer, he's the character that George Clooney plays in this movie, Syriana, that's
right.
Out. Yeah, and he said they showed a premiere of the movie in Washington, and the premiere was organized by the wives of the Pentagon generals, like General Casey's wife, etc., and that all of the top people were at the screening when it's hardly a pro-administration film. But anecdotally, he said just off the cuff that the top generals in the Pentagon had lost faith in their commander in chief. Is that something that you're hearing through the grapevine?
Well, I am hearing that there's a lot of animosity and a lot of distrust and mistrust between the what we call the civilian leadership on the third floor of the Pentagon and the military. You couldn't prove that by me with regard to the principal military officers making decisions with regard to Iraq and elsewhere, though, because what I see there in the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, the previous chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Dick Myers, and the current one, Pete Pace, what I see there is people who remind me of Vietnam military general officers who went along to get along.
Like the 5 o'clock follies syndrome. Well, just in closing, Colonel Wilkerson, given that that there are obviously some roiling going on behind the scenes, what do you think, and that you pointed out that the civilians are the ones inside the Pentagon that have been running that, and I think to cut to the chase, it's the neoconservatives. What is their future? Because, you know, one of the reasons I think that they got so emboldened was that people like Brent Scowcroft are too much of a gentleman to be shouted at on television by somebody like Cliff May. So they've, because they're skilled at TV soundbites and shouting down and filibustering, they seem to have had more play than they perhaps. I mean, these people are not written stuff. They're mostly, to me, they're mostly television scholars. So what's their fate? I mean, is there going to be some accountability here?
I would like to think so, but given our system, I doubt there will be very much that will be satisfying. I do think that one of the things they've shown from people like Richard Perle, who is head of the Defense Policy Board and then later is a sort of semi-government official, people like Douglas Feith, Paul Wolfowitz now at the World Bank, although I know Paul and used to think quite highly of him, at least his intellectual capabilities. I think these people have been exposed, and they've been exposed in a way that's going to fracture the what you might call the conservative movement. I consider myself a moderate, but probably tending towards conservative. And I know that Edmund Burke, Barry Goldwater, for that matter, would roll over in their graves if they heard these people called conservatives. They aren't conservatives. They're radicals. Whether it's Richard Perle, Douglas Feith, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, they're not conservatives. They're radicals. They're Jacobins. And I think that's been exposed. Their physical posture is Jacobinite. They just assume bankrupt the country. Their portrayal of American values and so forth is amoral. It's atraditional. It's certainly not conservative. Their portrayal of the Constitution is not conservative. It's very radical. So I think they're going to lose a lot of ground within their own ranks, and that's the way to lose ground fast.
Well, you know, just in closing, the vice president's latest speech was in front of AIPAC, and there's always been a feeling that the neocons were tied in with the Likudniks in Israel. But if this is true, how do the neocons explain that they're
Think about Likud for a moment. Likud's right. About to disappear from the face of the political earth.
And I was going to say that, guess what? The neocons' policies have emboldened and rewarded Iran and hardly rewarded Israel.
Worst enemy right now.
Yeah, so they haven't done much for Israel, have they?
They certainly have not, and I would dare say that the people I was hearing from in Israel back in 2001 and 2002 who were being muted at that time, that is, they were trying to say, Iraq is not the enemy, Iraq is not the enemy, Iran is, that they now have regained their voice and may be significantly influential on the new Kadima Party. I would hope so. They were right.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson.
Surely.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who is Secretary of State Colin Powell's Chief of Staff in the Department of State from August 2002 to 2005. And as we mentioned, in October 2005, Colonel Wilkerson, after considerable soul-searching, went public to tell the uncomfortable truths that Vice President Cheney had provided, the guidance that led to America's torture, disgrace in Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and elsewhere, that Secretary Powell's February 2003 presentation to the United Nations Security Council was the lowest point in his life, and that U.S. foreign policy had been hijacked by the Cheney-Rumsfeld cabal.
That was Ian Masters interviewing Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, March 12, 2006. Background Briefing and Live from the Left Coast were created and are hosted by Ian Masters. I'm the producer, Louis Vandenberg. The associate producer is Rusty Nguyen. Assistant producer, Carol Coote. The website is ianmasters.org.